I grew up in the suburbs. I've lived in various suburbs. Currently, I live in what's a suburban area of a small city that's really, in many ways, a suburb of Chicago. And I have found many things to like about the suburbs over the course of my life. I certainly wouldn't say that they're unequivocally bad, nor would I say they're unequivocally good. So what I think what you'll see in this discussion is the pluses and the minuses of how American housing and development has progressed over the years. Now, my favorite book on this subject is a book by the architectural historian Dolores Hayden. It's called Building Suburbia, Greenfields and Urban Growth, 1820 to 2000. It's a very readable, nice book for those of you of general interest in this topic. And she says at the outset that the history of the development of suburbs has to do with a tension between people wanting what she calls this threefold dream of home, nature, and community. Those three things, home, nature, and community, are what draw people to suburban developments. That is always being pushed and contested and challenged by the interests of developers, of governments to a certain extent, of commercial interests that are using land to make money, basically. So it's not in the interest of developers, financially, to build communities. It's in the interest of developers to get people on the land paying for houses or paying for a plot of land. So, and that goes way back to the 1820s. That doesn't start in the 1980s. She comes up with a phased development that has seven stages, and I'm going to take you through that today.
And her name again? Yeah.
Dolores Hayden.
Okay, great.
And you're welcome to look at this afterwards. So, here's a reason for suburban development right here. This is New York City in the later 19th century. And you can see why someone living here might have community, certain kind of community, but not the kind of home that's a dream, and certainly not nature. Pre-suburban middle-class housing often looked like this. There was certainly middle-class development in these cities, but it was in the form of row houses or tenement buildings, people living close together, having very little green space, and the building of major urban parks like Central Park, Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, places like that, is really a mid-19th century phenomenon as well. So town planners city planners in the early 1800s aren't thinking in terms of large green spaces for communities. Yeah. Okay, these are her seven phases, and I'm just going to list them right now, and then I'll go through them more closely. First, something that she calls the borderlands development, which begins in the 1820s. And the reason all of these dates have a dash at the end is because these are patterns of development that never end. They persist into the present, all of these different patterns. Picturesque enclaves from the 1850s on. Streetcar build-out starting in the 1870s. Mail order and self-built suburbs from the 1900s on, although that's not so much a phenomenon today, but it was very much through the 1940s. The sitcom suburbs from the 1940s, but really the 1950s and the 1960s. Edge nodes that begin in the 1960s. Persist today. And finally, the development of the rural fringes. And when people talk about sprawl today, they're largely talking about these last two categories, especially the rural fringes. Okay, well, starting with the borderlands. Here we are in the early 19th century. And what you see here is a kind of development that was not, these are not rural places in the sense of farmsteads, agriculturally based economies. These are places that people choose to live, and they're deeply connected to cities. They work there, they live in estates like that one in that Courier Knives print, and then they have transportation to the cities early on, often by waterway, later on by trains. And the appeal of the borderlands is you get out of the city. And it's an expensive thing to do at this point. It's largely the upper middle class and the wealthier people who are able to do this. But it's great. It's very appealing. Places like Brooklyn start like this. Brooklyn, as you know, is not exactly rural today, but initially it was a borderlands community and a pleasant place to live for the nature that was there. Picturesque enclaves are the next major phase of suburban development, beginning in the 1850s. And for those of you who were around yesterday for the talk on American houses, we spoke a little bit about the house designs of Andrew Jackson Downing, who had these romantic, picturesque houses. We looked at a Gothic-style cottage. And this is very much connected to the idea of picturesque enclaves, creating exactly what it says, a picture, something that's romantic and pleasant and framed the way a traveler would look at, say, a English country landscape. And two of the earliest of these picturesque enclaves are Llewellyn Park in Orange, New Jersey, developed by Andrew Jackson Davis, a well-known architect, and that's a place that Thomas Edison lived, for instance. It was a fairly wealthy development. And then Riverside, Illinois, is another well-known of these places. Frederick Law Olmsted, who was responsible for a lot of these big city parks in the mid to late 19th century, designed Riverside. Now, looking at these two plans of Riverside and Llewellyn Park, what would you say about the spatial development of these places relative to the land? What do you think might qualify? Just looking at the way it's platted out, what might qualify that as picturesque?
There's dedicated green space.
Dedicated green space, definitely.
Water.
Water.
No straight streets.
No straight streets. That's very important to these developers, the idea that you would get lost in a development, that it wouldn't have a sense of the grid, like many of the cities that were developing along the railroad lines at the same time. So, yes, those are three very important components of this. And these are largely for wealthy folk living in these places. They're the ones who can afford to move out of Chicago, for instance. Riverside is 11 miles from Chicago, so it depended on some kind of public transportation to get the men into their jobs in Chicago. Riverside had a little bit of trouble getting started economically, but 1871, Chicago Fire, certainly made people see the benefits of living out in the country and not in the city. This is what we might call well-planned suburban development. It's not for all economic classes, but there's a sense of the whole, a sense of developers thinking about a community, what makes life good, how you create parks, as you said, locate next to rivers and lakes, create meandering streets. So there's a consciousness about community. And though scholars who study, this is a picture, for instance, of a park in Llewellyn, Llewellyn Park. The entrance, the gatehouse, kind of an old English feel to it.
Is that the first gated community?
There were gated places within these communities as well. Some of the larger estates had gated.
Did they have gathering places too?
There were some. Riverside had some. And Riverside actually had a small area of shops and businesses as well. Now, the origins of this aren't entirely clear. For a long time, scholars would argue that they came out of the rural cemetery movement that was happening at the same time, places like Laurel Hill Cemetery in Philadelphia, which gave people a sense of these public, picturesque landscapes. And folks would take their picnics and go wander through these beautifully landscaped cemeteries. And many of the same landscape architects and developers were involved in the cemetery movement and the development of these picturesque enclaves. So there's definitely a connection. This author I've been talking about, Dolores Hayden, thinks that the real influence is coming from communitarian developments at the same time, places like the Shaker communities that have a sense of complete landscape, integrated housing and some work-related buildings, but definitely picturesque and definitely with a sense of community. The streetcar buildouts come along in the 1870s, and these are quite different from the picturesque enclaves, which continue the idea of the picturesque enclaves. This is much more middle-class housing, and not all single-family houses. Many of these are double, triple-unit buildings, especially in the Northeast. And these are dependent, by and large, on lines of transportation. So the streetcars going in, the horse-drawn carriages, later on the electrical, the buses coming through. So it's basically a straight line and there's a relationship between the developers and the railroad lines or the streetcar lines and the government allowing them to develop land right along these arteries. So the houses are middle-class housing, and they often are not too imaginative along straight lines. Here you have, there's garden space, there's definitely a sense of community, but it's not the rolling, picturesque look of the picturesque enclaves. And that's a very typical house for a northeastern streetcar suburb on the lower right there. And they become, now these places are quite close to the center of major cities, so if you think of places like Cambridge, Massachusetts even, which actually started more as a borderland, but then the places beyond that became streetcar suburbs, Roxbury for instance, to make a claim. Next, starting in the 1900s, is a mail order and self-built suburbs. And at this time, land development is exploding. Here's a view of El Segundo, California in about 1910, I believe, where there's a station and land. And these are developers plotting out land and selling it to individuals largely, or to small builders who will build their own houses, hire a builder to build their own house, develop a few houses. But no great large-scale massive developers like we see by the mid-century. This tends to be the smaller developers. And one component of that we also talked about yesterday is the mail order home. And so for those of you who were here yesterday, you know that Sears Roebuck sold about 100,000 of these homes.
We have a Sears house.
You do? Well, they're fun, aren't they? Until about 1940, but they weren't the only, Sears wasn't the only company doing this. There was a very big company called Aladdin Homes. And here you see Pacific Portable Construction Company in a parade float promoting their houses there in the upper left. And these houses came more or less with everything you needed. I think some of the things like nails and screws were included, but all of the finishing timber, basically it's two train cars that come to the train station in your town and you unload it. Now these houses weren't that easy to build. Imagine something with, I don't know, 60,000 pieces. I have a dollhouse for my daughter at home that I
have.
Yeah.
I had heard that they were numbered.
They were. Yes.
Were there IKEA style allocates?
I don't think they. There were all sorts of humor at the time about how impossible it was to actually build these things. The marketing was good, so you think, I'm clever with my hands, I can build this house, and then it comes and it's completely perplexing, so you end up having to hire a local builder to put it together for you, or you lose a piece of the molding from your door jamb, or, you know, it's a very crazy idea, and although we talk about them a lot, there are probably no more than 100,000 of the Sears houses, and maybe a few hundred thousand more from other builders at this time. But it was a great idea, and the rhetoric is wonderful in these things. Here's these are interior details for one of the Sears houses. And of course, the pride and joy of every woman is a cheerful, neat, conveniently planned kitchen. And here is the promise of that from Sears.
What years were these sold?
I think they start around 1915, 1917 through about 1940. Some of the companies go beyond that as well. There's a lot of literature about these Sears homes in particular.
But aren't they well built and they
are
fast?
They are well built, and if you built them according to specifications. And they do last, yes, they're
good. The wood is really strong because they were using old forests that weren't, the trees were were closer together, so they were stronger wood.
Yeah, well, you're the expert living in one of these, but I think the Sears houses all came from a lumberyard in, how do you pronounce it, Cairo, Illinois? Is that how you pronounce it, Cairo? So right on the train and out to the west, generally where they were going. Many more of, in this time though, the self-built house was common where a guy would be sure he could build his own house, and there was even an encouragement for people to just buy a piece of land, dig a foundation, pour it, live in the basement until you could figure out how to pay for the rest of the house, but build in stages because this idea of having your own home and your own piece of land was so strong and so promising. And many, many small builders were active at this time as well.
Under the description there, it says women spend 2/3 of every day in their kitchen.
Wow.
Yeah. This is before, you'll see pictures in a few minutes of the 1950s kitchen that's full of electrical appliances, and this is before a lot of those labor-saving devices. It's all very heavily gendered, obviously, you can tell by the rhetoric here. Now, at the same time, before we get into the mid-20th century suburbs, really the pattern for those post-war suburbs was being set in even the late 1920s, but especially in the 1930s with all the federal programs, the development of the Federal Housing Authority. And the government is getting involved on a very large scale in both encouraging individuals to get mortgages and ensuring those mortgages, that legislation develops, but also getting in the business of housing for lower income families. And it's never even close. The amount of money that the government spends to build houses for the middle class far, far, far exceeds anything that's ever done in terms of low income housing. But there are experiments in the 1930s, and you kind of wonder what would happen if these things had become more popular, if developers had turned to these models, because places like, here you're looking at Sunnyside, Queens, which was development from the 1930s that my father-in-law actually grew up in, and his parents were immigrants from Germany, and they were very excited to be still very close to New York City where they worked, but in a development that felt like there was nature, for one thing, because these were multiple unit buildings, but there was a lot of green space between them, and they opened up into common green areas behind. They were integrated with businesses and shops in the neighborhood, so very well-planned kind of community, and Sunnyside's having a renaissance right now. People are very appreciative of the kind of community that develops there. Nothing over 3 stories tall, fairly spacious apartments, but affordable for middle and even some lower middle class families.
Rental or purchase?
These, I think, were both, as is fairly common. The idea of, because some of these were single unit houses as well, but by and large, well, in the case of my husband's father-in-law, his family, his grandparents, who were very good at buying property and starting bakeries and things like that, they were your classic immigrants who just knew how to work really hard and invest in things that mattered. They bought a building and then they rented out other apartments within that building to distant family members who had just come from Germany, things like that. So I think that was a pretty common experience there as well. Okay, now, the sitcom suburbs of post-World War II. I think in the popular culture, when we think about the suburbs and all of the things that that conjures up for us, we're by and large thinking about the 50s and the 60s. And this cartoon expresses so well, because it's from a merchandising magazine in 1957, this exodus from the city, all these people going, and the consumerist energy that's going with them. Because in many ways, this was a collaboration between developers and manufacturers as well, who were, so GE, for instance, is very closely related to the development of places like Levittown, and worked very hard to get their dishwashers in those new houses. So there's getting people out of the cities to larger spaces that they need to fill up with more things. And these are fairly small houses, but compared to the spaces they left, they're expansive. Now, kind of have two, in the popular culture, kind of two ways of looking at the suburbs. One is the Leave It to Beaver, which was, as I'm sure you've all seen, reruns. Or if not the originals, this was the Cleaver family living in this wonderful bucolic community, and every problem could be solved, and there was a great sense of family and neighbor, and that's considered now by many people to be not only a myth, but a dangerous sort of myth, a myth that led to a lot of disillusionment and problems in the suburbs, because life never lived up to Leave It to Beaver. That was a marketing tool, not a reality. And then you had Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, a great Cary Grant movie from the late 1940s, where he's an advertising executive in New York. He's living in a one-bathroom, four-bedroom apartment with his family. He's very cramped, and he starts to have this idea that he's going to go buy a piece of land in Connecticut and build his dream house there. And he's kind of a sucker. He gets duped by all the people out in Connecticut who are much smarter than this city slicker. But in the end, things coalesce, and he gets his dream house out in the suburbs. And just another example of marketing, when this film came out, there were 70 copies of this house that were in different parts of the United States, full of consumer goods, and people could go and visit these houses and understand the dream of Mr. Blandings and translate that into their own dreamscape. So, then on the other side, you have a large variety of things that come up a little later. These are more contemporary movies that are very critical of what these suburbs were about, that they were places that valued conformity over individuality, where people were forced into roles that they weren't naturally able to perform, that it was fake, that it was hollow, that nothing was real there. There wasn't real community. There was just a lot of role playing. So you've probably seen some of these movies. And wonderful images of dystopian communities in the suburbs. So what was actually happening there is something I'm trying to figure out in my current research on the churches that are developed in these post-war suburbs. Little bit of information about what's happening. Levittown, you often think about Levittown, but most development wasn't like this. Most development was much smaller scale, but Levittown is kind of emblematic of what we think of as these suburbs. So before the 1950s, a third of home building in America is done by individuals. And a third of home building, this is single family home building, is done by small builders, building maybe three homes a year. By the late 1950s, two-thirds of American homes are being built by these very large-scale developers, like the Levitt family. Small houses, nearly identical houses, on smallish lots. Some of these developments have a sense of community built into them. One that I'm looking at fairly closely is Park Forest, Illinois. Maybe you're familiar with that. It's about 30 miles south of Chicago. Real boom town, very much like Levittown. Those developers tried very consciously to build community spaces, to develop churches. There was even, this may be of interest to you, but the builders hired a chaplain to be the chaplain for the community, an ecumenical chaplain that would help people connect with different religious groups and support the moral core of the community. Levittown was very different. It was much more simply selling the houses and making money. A lot of innovation in home building came out of this. This is the first big development to use cement slab with radiant heat, for instance, and all of these Levittown houses had that. And it was very big on, well, I forget whether it's called horizontal integration or vertical integration, but where you systematize everything to make it extremely efficient. Now, the dark side of these places was, in the case of Levittown, for instance, exclusions. So African Americans, for instance, and people of other ethnic groups simply were not allowed to buy houses in Levittown for several decades. You were allowed to have a gardener or a housekeeper who was a person of color, but you couldn't buy a house if you were. And this rhetoric was very appealing. Everybody lives on the same side of the tracks. They have no slums to fret about, no families of conspicuous wealth to envy, no traditional upper crust to whet and thwart their social aspirations. So the sense of a very lovely sort of peaceful existence with people like you. And it was integrated in the sense of religion, for instance. There was a Protestant Catholic Jew umbrella in this period, so there were many Jews in Levittown and in Park Forest. Park Forest, incidentally, was, there weren't these restrictions, and it was very peacefully integrated in the 1960s with African American families coming in. But you get a sense of the dream here. What's the appeal to largely returning veterans at this time who are just desperate to find, there's such a tremendous housing shortage after World War II. So these buildings are just popping up all over. Something like 10 million housing units in the 15 years after World War II.
They have sidewalks, so when did people get rid of the sidewalks?
Parts of it have sidewalks. This may be, I'm not sure exactly what part of Levittown that is, but yeah, and sidewalks are expensive for builders. So a lot of new developments now, I know, don't put sidewalks in. In some places, like they would try to incorporate, in Levittown in particular, try to incorporate the curb into the sidewalk to cut the cost of building sidewalks. So there's no green space between the sidewalk and the street often. Did you have a question? Thought I saw a hand back there. Any questions? Okay. Here's what may be familiar to you too, a ranch house introduced in the early 1950s, costing about $10,000, which was a lot for a young family, but manageable. And there you see no cash required from veterans. This is the Veterans Administration with helping with home loans so that vets could get in the homes. The interior of one of these houses, so we talked about this a little bit yesterday. And here's the ball field in Levittown.
What was the square footage of those houses approximately?
Average, high 800s, about 900 square feet. Sometimes they'd have unfinished second stories that you could, and there was a lot of literature about do-it-yourself work at that time. This is the age of the hobbyist and finishing off your attic, that sort of thing. So here's the social world of, in Park Forest, there were multi-unit buildings that were built before the single-family homes. These were townhomes with two or three units per building. And when I talk to people who raised their kids in these communities, they say that was the best time of our lives. It was a whole bunch of young families. The parents are, the average age of the adults there is about 30. There are thousands of kids running around, and it's a very exciting time. Now, the kids who grew up there have slightly different opinions, but it was like, for the parents, it was wonderful, a great sense of community.
What are they supposed to be doing in there?
Yeah, we thought we were fairly progressive as parents, and my mother tried so hard to get me to see the virtue of the playpen, and now I can see what she was talking about in retrospect. Putting up those gates all over the house was much harder than just blocking them in a 6x6 square. It's group consumerism. This is an illustration that shows how legible the interiors of these houses were if you were walking by at night. Mm-hmm. And many people in these suburbs talked about how they loved to walk through their town at night looking in people's windows, seeing what... Yeah, this is fun. I actually like to do this myself. But you see what the latest thing that someone's bought. And there's a lot of, oh, my neighbor just got a dishwasher, I need to do that. Or, oh, that's an interesting color that the Joneses painted their living room. Oh, did you see that nice glass top coffee table? So, but it's an exciting kind of group consumerism as well as a competitive one, of course. There was a lot of pressure to have a lawn. This is kind of a new thing in the mid-20th century. People moving from essentially urban areas where they never thought about a lawn had to be taught how to make their yard look good. And so here's a little brochure from Levittown, you know. This is what you need to do. You need to, there was a sentence in here I'm trying to find. Oh, no single feature of a suburban residential community contributes so much to the charm and beauty of the individual home and locality as well-kept lawns. And so you get a sense of the pressure for that. Now, this is a marketing image about the joy of consumerism. You can just see that. This is the promise of what your life will be like if you buy fill in the blank, a dishwasher, a new washing machine. So here's a Christmas morning with a happy suburban family. Here's an interior of a kitchen. I think this is a Levittown kitchen interior, maybe Park Forest one. But very well organized, a lot of new electrical appliances, space saving and work saving devices. And although we think in terms often of the Levitt towns, this is just a street in Valparaiso, Indiana, where you can see a builder went in and did the same thing that was happening in Levitt town without taking care of any of the other amenities that might be needed for a community. And by and large, that's the way it happened. Builders went in, built the houses, left, and the city government and the local community was forced to pay taxes to develop schools, think about parks, think about community centers. That wasn't, for the vast majority of these developments, that wasn't the concern of the builder. The builder was just selling lots and selling houses.
Are those houses as little as they look?
Yeah, these are about that 800, 900 square foot. These are in
they look like they're 300.
And they do, well, they compared to what we see today, that's true. So
they don't have the triple garages that are built today.
No, they don't. Many of these had no garage or a carport, and we get snow in Indiana, of course, so some of them have built garages. Not so many additions here, and it's a they're livable houses, but it's not the high rent district of town, certainly not. Okay, now moving quickly through the last two of these sections. This comes from Hayden's Building Suburbia. Edge nodes are a fairly new phenomenon in American suburbs. And she talks about Tyson's Corner, Virginia, which is out near Dulles Airport, as being one of these. Schaumburg, Illinois, may be more familiar to many of you. These are, as she says, an old commercial strip with all of the buildings exploded in scale, or a model with all the building blocks for both suburb and city thrown on the ground by a two-year-old having a tantrum. That's what these places feel like. There's residential housing there, but people don't like to live in these places. They don't know what they are. There are hotels, there are large office complexes, there are small suburban developments, there's a mall around every corner. They're not thought of as towns where you live, yet these are all over the United States now, on the fringes of major urban cities like Washington and Chicago. So Schaumburg had, by 2000, 75,000 residents and 73,000 jobs. So there are a lot more people working there than living there. 30 million square feet of commercial and office space as well. Kind of empties out in the evening. It feels like being on Lower Manhattan and Wall Street on a weekend. There's all this evidence of business, but nothing's going on. And finally, the rural fringes. And these are images of New England, but you can see this all over. And Hayden says, since the 1980s, new development on the rural fringes of edge nodes has expanded to cover more square miles than central cities, older suburbs, and edge nodes combined. And I don't know if I mentioned this or not, but by 2000 also, more people lived in suburbs than in cities and rural areas combined. Actually, I think that was a decade or so earlier than that. So most Americans are now living in something that we would consider suburbs. And the problems with this sort of development are obvious. It's taking away farmland and timberland, building on rather large lots. Often these places are attached to quaint towns like Litchfield, Connecticut, which would be a very desirable place to live. So you build a suburban enclave on the outskirts of a small town rather than on the outskirts of a city. And a book that I'm halfway through right now that I could recommend to you is about, this is especially interesting from the development point of view, it's called Last Harvest, How a Cornfield Became New Daleville. Real Estate Development in America from George Washington to the Builders of the 21st Century and Why We Live in Houses Anyway. It's by a man named Witold Rybczynski, who also wrote a great book called Home, History of an Idea, that some of you may have read. And this is about development in the rural fringes of Lancaster County, which is a little bit west of Philadelphia. Lovely rural area, and all the jockeying between local residents and developers and local governments and zoning policy and how these things happen now in these rural areas. One more thing I'd like to mention is new urbanism. This came up a little bit yesterday. There is a movement within some of the architecture schools and some of the developers to create. They think the solution isn't getting rid of the suburbs, that the suburbs are in fact ideal places to live if they're done right. So the solution is creating better suburbs that have some of the feelings of a small, some of the feeling of a small town. And these are images from Florida and I think a new urbanist development outside Washington, D.C. So a lot more multiple unit housing, things that look like on the, here, on the upper left, like an old 18th century Georgian townhouse, community centers, community pools, schools integrated into the development, central parks, rather small lots, but large green spaces for the whole community to share. And these places have a lot of admirers. They're not inexpensive places to live generally, but they're fairly successful. So this is where we are now. I'm wondering what you think about all of this, what your own experiences have been, what you think this means for Christians. What kind of places should we be living? Is there something valuable in a suburb? Is there something sinister in a suburb that we should be wary of? One thing I didn't mention is that in suburbs today, at least 25% of the housing units in new suburbs is multiple unit housing. And that's projected to increase now as it gets more and more difficult to own your own home with the mortgage crisis and so forth. And these aren't low, it's not low income housing necessarily. It's often young professionals who don't stay in a place more than 2 years and prefer to rent than purchase a home. So that's also an increasing trend in suburban development. So, what do you think? What questions do you have? Yes?
I had a friend that moved from northern Minnesota to Florida to be head of the foundation for Celebration.
Yes, Celebration Florida, that's Disney's.
Oh, you did talk about it already.
Yeah, well, I talked to you about it yesterday, but not today. That's Walt Disney's development.
Yeah, and
it's one of these new urbanist places.
Oh, okay. Because we went then and drove through it. And when you say urbanist, I don't think of it. I mean, it was kind of out in the countryside. It was sort of very...
What did you think? Did you like it?
No.
Why did you not like it?
It felt very cookie cutter. It felt very controlled. It really reminded me of Pleasantville.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just heard kind of rumors about that things have not gone well there. I don't know if that's just... they left, I know, and I never did get to talk to her about what it was like. You know, there were, I think, attempts to really do things about community because she had been head of a foundation in our community, mm-hmm. and they recruited her to come, and that was supposed to be a foundation that helped with, you know, some of the...
Well, I think you put your finger on one of these problems that persist for planners, and that's that you can have all the pieces of what you think makes a good community, but is that something you can design and build, or is it something that has to grow organically out of a place and a people? And so, and it's Disney too, so it, you know, has that sense of fakeness. There's also a problem, which I see in Park Forest now, of any community that's built all at once, especially as it ages, because everything gets old all at once, including the residents. So you have people who've lived in Park Forest all their lives, and they're in their 70s and 80s now, and they're just depressed about what's happened to that community. Everything looks old, new money hasn't come in. This wonderful, thriving central shopping center that was planned, it was cutting-edge planning in the 1960s, has now deteriorated because of big box development on the outskirts of that region. So things need to grow and change. It's just very hard to plan a good community.
Wasn't some of this built, pattern of development based on the easy availability of petroleum?
Oh, yes.
What is that?
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you, Dorothy. Especially the sitcom suburbs.
Yeah.
Were based on, originally had the streetcar suburbs that were based on transportation networks. And once you get interstate highways, especially the edge node developments are all about major developers look at which ways the highways go when they figure out where they're going to place those things. And certainly that's one of the problems that the big complaints with the fringe developments now is that that's based on people being willing to do an hour, even an hour and a half commute.
A lot of these developments, the curvy roads and everything just aren't conducive to buses going through or
right.
public transit.
So a lot, yes, absolutely, and a lot, that's a scary thing when you think about it, that a lot of the way we live as Americans is dependent on cars. That's the way that we've built, that's the way we continue to build, and it's not certainly not sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My goal in life is to never own a lawn.
Yeah, look around.
Just to add on to that, I just read this morning that the gas-powered lawnmower this mowing the lawn is going to put as much pollution in the air, I could hardly believe it.
Yeah.
But it's a book over there, as driving a car, I actually, mine is at 600 some miles, but maybe it was 300 some. Anyway, it was a tremendous number of miles driving a car, 1 hour mowing with a gas.
It's because it's a two-stroke mower.
And it also was talking about that is the big, the turf grass is the biggest crop in the U.S. It's not corn, it's not wheat, it's not turf grass.
I've forgotten your name, I'm sorry, it's...
Oh, sure.
What, your name? Sorry.
Oh, I'm Sean Grzeski.
Yeah, and he's an urban, works with greening neighborhoods, so he's the guy to go to for a lot of these questions.
Well, in the Twin Cities, we have, in Minnesota, we have a program called Green Step Cities, where it's being launched this summer, where cities can do a number of different things to reduce their carbon footprint, their stormwater footprint, and their solid waste footprint, and then they can get recognition. You can get a sign. They used to have these Star City signs, and now they have a Green Step City sign. So I work with the Alliance for Sustainability, and we get together about 8 to 10 suburbs together for roundtables where the citizens and city staff can hear what each city is doing to go green. So a lot of the suburbs will have incentives for people to put in rain gardens. They'll have tours of the rain gardens. They're working some on permeable infrastructure that lets the rainwater filter through. More movement toward putting in community gardens, like in Apple Valley and Barnesville, people are working on getting community gardens. And so there's a lot that can be done to help the suburban communities to have more places where people to gather and get to know each other, as well as to lower their carbon footprint and their stormwater footprint.
I was going to say, I live in a suburb in Silicon Valley, and I love our neighborhood, but it's funny in that it's very competitive. You know, that sort of speaks to me, right? Because a lot of competitive people. So first you have, like, the people don't have their windows open, but there was definitely a competition of, like, who had the biggest flat screen TV for a while. Like, the guys were like, oh, it's just a bit too. It was just really too funny, right? But now it's switched this year. Now it's like, who's the greenest? So like, oh, haven't you done the water survey? They'll come out and tell you how much water you're using. Like if you water your lawn the wrong time of day, because in California it's a water shortage, so you're only supposed to water it first thing in the morning. But we don't have law about it, because, you know, our water district, but it's sort of known what, you know. Anyway, and so our neighbor just put like rocks on their parkway. And I was like, can you believe it? It's so ugly. And I'm like, honey, it's not cool to have a green lawn anymore. You know, you don't have rocks, you know.
The best part about letting it go brown is you don't have to mow it.
Yeah, but it's really interesting how now there's a competition to be green, you know. But not have a green lawn.
Yeah, I don't think that's reached the end.
Yeah.
California. Chris, were you trying to say something?
Well, I was just going to say that I feel the pinch of competing goods, because Sonia and I have lived in three different trolley suburbs that were all built around the turn of the century and were not incorporated in the city when they were built and now are, in Atlanta and in New Haven, and now in St. Paul. And there are neighborhoods that are attractive, that's partly because they were built in such a way that most everything you need is within walking a couple of blocks to the library, the bank, the grocery store, the coffee shop, you know, and on and on. And that's also made them really attractive to many people, so they've ended up being among the more expensive neighborhoods in each of these towns. And so then they create this sort of lifestyle enclave as, some people call those neighborhoods, where it's a bunch of like-minded, progressive, fairly well-off people, mm-hmm. usually white, not always, but so there's this really good thing there. It's sort of livability and walkability and so forth, but then it's this exclusive thing too that comes with it. And no, it's a kind of implicit redlining or whatever you call it, you know, because only certain people can afford it.
Mm-hmm.
So. Those neighborhoods seem to me to be built in such a way that they do foster something that's really good. But you'd have to really be careful about how you structured accessibility in the neighborhood in order to not have it become an economic sort of...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
I want to know what the positive things are for suburbia for the urban for the cities, you know, I can think of tax drain and all that. Is there something about suburbia that helps the urban core thrive?
That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, Minneapolis is part of Hennepin County, which has a lot of suburbs. So our library system is being funded through the suburbs. There's a lot of, we could put in light rail because the county had such a large tax base. So at least in the Twin Cities, some of the suburbs can subsidize the urban area through the tax base.
It used to be the case that certain cultural institutions were centered in the city centers, mm-hmm. and that the suburbs were the people who supported the arts in particular. But now, actually, a lot of those theaters and so forth have been moving out to the suburbs. I don't know if that's a reversible trend or a big trend, but so I think in the past it had been that you had a greater concentration of people that could support that sort of thing in the cities.
And even in a smaller city like Indianapolis, suburb Carmel is just building just a multi-million dollar arts center. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're literally 10 minutes away from downtown.
Most of that has to do with, I'm an urban planner, and most of that has to do with your local government taxing structure and who the haves and have-nots are. And for me, I have a lot of my Christian values are wrapped up in my work of community inclusivity and people being engaged in their communities, in your own community and others, and making sure that we're willing to pay the tax burden that equalization of the economics requires, so that it's not only the Disney-esque white upper middle class that can then afford the parks and library services that help create that little village. So for me, the challenge as a Christian is that I want to live in those nice areas, but I think we do have an obligation to look at the economic situation, and that is local government, regional government, state government, and your tax dollars. And if you're willing to pay to lay the infrastructure or upkeep the infrastructure that got you where you are, that the generation before paid, and what is our balance of willingness to pay into the system that helps create that public-private partnership. Most of these endeavors are public-private partnerships. They're not just architecture, they're local government and private sector and policy wonks and, you know, moms in tennis shoes all working together, but then it needs to be sustained. And that's part of the Green Movement, should be sustaining that civic culture that we now are seeing again emerging like we had in the 70s. And I think as a Christian, it's a challenge. This generation, can we make what, for me in the 70s, I was coming of age and I was a budding environmentalist and I was all this great stuff and went to Congress and worked there as an intern. And then all the money dried up because policies changed. And so then there weren't green jobs anymore. They didn't call them green then, I can't remember. We're in that same spot 30 years later, and I think the challenge as Christians is to continue that in a smart and intelligent way, and we're going to have to give up some of our dollars for the greater good. That's my little spin on.
I grew up and now live in Portland, Oregon, and Portland has worked very hard to preserve the neighboring farmland and restricted growth boundaries and all that sort of thing. And that sounds lovely. However, the downside to that is the house I grew up in, my folks paid $11,500 for it in 1948. So that was fairly spendy in those days, but you know, my folks were able to do it. That same house is $732,000 now, and I don't know who lives in those houses. I don't know how they can afford those mortgages. And so the people that are even middle class, let alone lower middle class or whatever, are forced out of those neighborhoods and into places where they have to trade the commute for for square footage of the house to get enough house that they want. Now they've got an hour commute each way, and then the traffic gets all tangled up. And there's some really major unintended consequences to that growth boundary stuff. And I don't see that in the newspaper. I don't see that they're thinking, wait a minute, what have we done here? It's just happened. People that buy a house for $40,000 could sell it for $600. You know, they're happy. And there's a lot of infill now, which I think is a good thing. The architecture is a little bit jarring, but I still think it's a good thing. But even those places are at least $200,000.
Those are really interesting and important observations. Two things. One is that this could all be changing. We've had this housing bubble that's been going on for a while, and what the availability of housing, the value that people have hoped that their homes would sustain, and it's not being sustained. So that's going to reconfigure things a lot in housing. And I forgot the other thing I was going to say. But good points.
Yeah. It's all location. I mean, I'm looking at $400,000 for 700 square feet on the fifth floor.
Oh.
Yeah.
In what town?
Vancouver.
Vancouver, B.C.
Oh, I remember the other thing too, and that has to do with places like Vancouver, where you have they're very desirable places to live, and in those places, the first ring suburbs are still desirable places to live. But in a lot of cities, those first ring suburbs are now having a lot of problems. People just keep moving out. So one of the concerns is what happens to those places between the center city and the suburbs that are now being filled increasingly by non-related people who live in them, who aren't family units in any way. They're just sharing space. They don't care about the neighborhoods in the same way because they're kind of passing through. And how do you get people, to get back to her point, how do you get people home and nature and community in a way that's sustainable and that's available for people across the economic spectrum? It doesn't have to all look the same, but.
To follow up on the comment with the person who with the green, those three categories of home, nature, and community, it seems to me that the Christian community maybe can't define home or nature so much, but we have a wonderful opportunity to define what community is. And it seems to me that often in my experience of suburbia, individual McDonald's franchise of the local flavor of the Christian church defines community as come to our place. And we'll shape, a wonderful community here in this little franchise that you have to drive to come to. And perhaps a real new challenge is for the Christian community to, in a cooperative and ecumenical kind of way, define that in a much larger way. Because people crave it. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories of where we live, which is kind of a fringe rural area, all competitive developments, that have little tiny green spaces in the little, and a couple of big mega churches that say, come to our place, but no community center. When the girls' high school, the high school is the center of the community, basically. And when they won the high school state softball championship, they had to go to the new Meijer, which out here I guess would be a Super Target or whatever. And the store had just opened on one of the highways, and it literally was the town center, the new Walmart, and the kids were running through the store, whooping and hollering. Security was like, what are these kids going to do here? But they had to go someplace where there was some sense of the larger community.
Another comment I just wanted to share was I had just an amazing opportunity recently to be on a university panel. They're developing their green MBA. And it was fascinating to listen to the MBA folks who were already graduates and running businesses talking about that fast cycle, the cycle of feedback that they have is 18 months to 2 years. We can't think 20 years. And so that's where I really think that a lot of this is partnerships between public and private sector, because they really don't have that luxury to have, in some cases, some of the economic models that they work on and that are international don't support sustainable community models, and how we do that and what our call is as Christians to be part of that. And I really think that our call is not to be anti-government and anti-business and anti-anything to be, but to be truly ecumenical in the roles that we all play, not just the faith communities that we come from. But that, to me, is the ultimate in community. And if we can figure out some of these policy and economic value things, I have a great hope and passion. And I was thinking of teaching a class here maybe in 2 years, because this is a moment in our history that is just very exciting. I feel a lot of passion and complexity, and if we can crack this nut for the next generation, it means what a time to live in, what a crisis to have.
I just want to say one thing that I've been thinking about lately. It has to do with stewardship, and I'm as Christians, we think a lot about stewardship, but as Americans, we think a lot about 18 months to 2 years. And so we think about spending money in terms of where is this gonna go right now? What's the best use for this right now? It's very hard, especially to get, I'm just on a church building committee right now, so I'm thinking about this, but it's hard to get people to invest more now for the sake of saving things in the future. Because we don't like to spend the money, It's a very complex thing, of course, with stewardship, but this idea of stewardship that's creating a better world for people a generation and two or two along is not American. We don't think about our places as places where our children will be or our grandchildren will be. We're kind of passing through. And so thinking about the earth and our communities in terms of future generations is a really important component of stewardship, I think, and that relates to what you're saying. One more comment.
I want to publicly commend Vancouver, BC. I went on a field trip there in the 1980s, and there's a neighborhood, you probably know the name of it, big, huge, beautiful old houses, gorgeous estates. And that neighborhood was deteriorating because people just could not afford to paint the outside, let alone some of the other things that needed to happen. And they really scratched their head, and what they came up with is that these houses could build a junior house on the property, either to the side or the backyard. And so the big house has 4,000 or 5,000 square feet, the little one has 2,000 square feet, and if the big one has a gray house with yellow shutters and two white pillars, the little house does. And it brought together a whole industry of architects to copy these houses and downsize them for the little ones. It was fun to drive in the neighborhood and see and people could stay in the big one, rent out the little one, and afford to paint the house. Or they could stay in the little one, rent out the big one.
There's a lot of subdivision, a lot of duplex building now, our mayor is actually, or the former mayor now, Vancouver's run out of land, full stop. We've got the ocean, we've got the mountains, and then we have the agricultural land reserve. So they have to densify, and that's what they've been doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's just no land to build on.
Yeah, but that neighborhood was long on charge.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all for your comments. That's very interesting.